Hello, John Dennis here on Wednesday, April the 15th. Today, North Korea ratchets up the tension, vowing to resume its nuclear program and never to return to talks.
The way it works with North Korea is a bit like it used to work with the Kremlin in the days of the Cold War, when you had Kremlinologists trying to work out who was up and who was down.
Also today, the row over a plot by an aide to the Prime Minister to smear top Tories reignites Gordon Brown's bitter feud with senior Blairites.
Stephen Byers, for instance, said, "I've been the victim of McBride's aggressive and hostile media briefing on a number of occasions."
And as Britain ends its military campaign in Iraq, Colonel Tim Collins looks back at the successes and failures of the episode.
The performance in Iraq swept away any admiration the Americans had for the British Army. And I think that they looked at certainly not the soldiers, but the commanders and the lack of aggression and the incompetence at that level.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
Before we hear about any of that, here's Bill Overton with the news and a look at the papers.
Scotland Yard has suspended a second officer over allegations of brutality at the G20 demonstrations in London. The officer, who holds the rank of sergeant, has been stood down from duties after the emergence of new video evidence. The footage shows an officer hitting a woman, then appearing to beat her with a baton. An investigation is to be carried out by the Independent Police Complaints Commission. The IPCC is already looking into the actions of a policeman who came forward after the publication of video showing Ian Tomlinson being beaten shortly before he died. Gordon Brown's expected to come under further pressure today over the email scandal engulfing the government. The Prime Minister's efforts to distance himself from a culture of vicious briefing by his inner circle have been derailed by the intervention of three former Blairite ministers. Alan Milburn, Stephen Byers and Frank Field say they've been victims of briefing campaigns from within the Labour Party, and they've joined the Tories in calling for a shake-up at Downing Street. The inventor of genetic fingerprinting is warning the government's risking public support for the national DNA database by holding genetic details of innocent people. Professor Sir Alec Jeffries has condemned the policy of keeping everyone arrested on the database, regardless of whether they are later convicted. He says it means that large numbers of innocent people are on the register unnecessarily. Professor Jeffries also wants to see improved genetic testing procedures, warning that the current system could result in a miscarriage of justice. Thousands of people are preparing to descend on the Anfield football ground near Liverpool to remember victims of the Hillsborough disaster 20 years ago. 96 Liverpool fans were crushed to death on this day in 1989 during an FA Cup semi-final tie with Nottingham Forest at the stadium in Sheffield. Families of the victims are still not satisfied with the investigation into the disaster and are calling for an inquest to be reopened. They believe some of their loved ones could have survived if they'd been given proper medical assistance. Sport, and a 4-4 draw between Chelsea and Liverpool has given the home team a 7-5 aggregate win at Stamford Bridge. Chelsea will now face Barcelona in the Champions League semi-finals in 2 weeks' time. Let's take a look at the papers now, and there are reports of the much-to-hope-for green shoots of recovery in some of today's editions. The Financial Times quotes US President Barack Obama as saying that aggressive efforts to boost the US economy are starting to bear fruit. And the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke, is also cautiously optimistic that the world's largest economy is now no longer falling off a cliff. Back home, the Times carries the latest monthly housing survey by the Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors, which shows property sales springing to life. The RICS remains cautious, though, saying any recovery will only gain momentum when the credit markets unfreeze. The Express also reports on the vital signs that hint at revival in housing market. The Daily Mail is angry that just 6 months after bailout costing millions, greedy bankers reward themselves with a new round of huge bonuses. The paper tells us that Goldman Sachs has promised thousands of staff a 33% pay boost after it returned to profit. The paper's apoplectic that such payouts should again be on the agenda so soon after Citibank has brought the world economy to the brink of ruin. The Telegraph piles the pressure on the government over the email scandal, quoting Tory leader David Cameron as saying Gordon Brown is personally responsible for what's gone on. And it carries a picture of a rather unhappy-looking Tory MP Nadine Dorries holding up the letter she received from Gordon Brown. She was the subject of one of the smears and says that the PM has failed to address the seriousness of the situation in his response. Finally, the tabloids carry extensive coverage of the jailing of Jade Goody's widower. The Sun has interviewed the cab driver who Jack Tweed attacked, who says 12 weeks, he should have been locked up for 2 years. Stephen Wilkins reckons Tweed's been given a lenient sentence because of who he is. The Mirror, meanwhile, says that Jack Tweed's family see the sentence as unnecessarily harsh for the same reason. His lawyer argued that he is a changed man after coping with Jade's illness and subsequent death. More news and comment throughout the day with Guardian.co.uk.
North Korea has said it'll boycott nuclear disarmament talks after the United Nations condemned the launch of what Pyongyang said was a satellite last week. The rocket in question can carry warheads, and that led other countries, including America, to view it as a covert military exercise. North Korea now says it'll restart the nuclear program it had dismantled under an international deal. Our foreign affairs columnist Simon Tisdall explains why relations between North Korea and the international community have broken down.
Well, in recent months, they fell out with the Bush administration as it neared the end of its term over North Korea's designation as a sponsor of terrorism by the US State Department. They really objected to that characterization, and indeed the Bush administration, in a concession to Pyongyang, lifted that designation before it left office. But prior to that, the North had walked out of the six-party talks. This is the process of negotiations between North Korea, South Korea, Japan, Russia, China and the United States, which has been going on since 2003, because they were looking for all sorts of concessions and assistance. And the U.S., basically, and backed up by the others, wouldn't provide it without clear and irrefutable and inspected evidence that North Korea was dismantling its nuclear weapons capabilities.
And now Pyongyang has said it will never participate in the six-party talks. I mean, big word, never.
Yes, and to be taken with a pinch of salt, since they've walked out before and come back. And because it's never quite clear who's talking. This was a foreign ministry statement. It may represent the considered view of Kim Jong-il, the leader, or the North Korean leaders, or it may just be a fit of pique following the passing last night in New York of a UN Security Council statement which censured North Korea for its missile launch earlier this year over the Sea of Japan, which many Western countries interpreted not as an attempt to put a satellite into orbit, as the North claimed, but as a dry run for an intercontinental ballistic missile.
And there's been all these rumours in the last few months about the health of the North Korean dictator Kim Jong-il. How do you sort of read that feeding into the diplomatic crisis that we're now seeing?
The way it works with North Korea is a bit like it used to work with the Kremlin in the days of the Cold War, when you had Kremlinologists trying to work out who was up and who was down and what the latest thing was, because it was so opaque and there was no firm information about what was going on. It's a bit like that in Pyongyang, which is a very isolated capital city, very few Western visitors, very few diplomatic contacts. It seems fairly certain that Kim suffered some kind of heart problem, probably a stroke last year, maybe in August, and that he's been recovering ever since. There were rumours at one point that he may have died. He appeared in public quite recently when his position as a sort of overall leader of North Korea was reaffirmed, and he looked thin and ill and tired. So that would seem to confirm that if not a heart problem, then he has had some health problem. That's led to all sorts of speculation about a power struggle to replace him. He has promoted his brother-in-law, but that doesn't necessarily mean that he's the heir apparent. He has various sons. Some of them are sometimes mentioned as possible successors, but nothing is clear.
And what about President Obama's handling of this crisis? Because it's a big challenge to him when North Korea fired that missile last week.
Yes, the missile launch coincided with Obama's speech in Prague about a new crusade for counterproliferation, for ridding the world of nuclear weapons. And it does bring this new US president hard up against the reality that other American presidents and Western leaders have had to confront over about 10 or 15 years now. Bush Sr., the Clinton administration, and Bush Jr. all had this problem of what do you do to force a nascent nuclear power like North Korea, which is a fundamentally untransparent, undemocratic regime, to do what you want, and that is to divest itself of these weapons of mass destruction. Short of invading them, no one's really come up with an answer to that yet.
And the US doesn't necessarily see things the same way as China, Russia, South Korea, Japan, and the other members of the UN Security Council too.
Yeah, well, Obama's got to show that he's more than just a man of fine speeches. He's got to show that he can actually implement policies that work in this and other areas. And although his administration is maintaining the UN statement, not a binding resolution, but the UN statement was a strong and coordinated response, it was watered down considerably because of opposition from China and Russia, principally, China being the North's biggest trading partner and its de facto protector, which said that that if you pushed the North Koreans too hard, they may walk away from the six-party talks, which in fact is what has actually happened. And Russia sort of seemed to tag along with that on the basis that on the overall principle of non-interference in the sovereign affairs of another country. You know, this is an argument they always trot out in these situations. So there's a split between Russia and China, and probably behind them various developing and third world countries who take similar views. And on the other side, the United States, Japan, which is very worried, quite understandably, about this neighbour with lots of missiles and not a lot of control, and Western countries like Britain and France, which are generally in favour of denuclearisation of the Korean Peninsula.
Simon Tisdall, and there's full coverage today at guardian.co.uk/world. Now, The Guardian's audio output has been collectively nominated in the podcast category for the Webbies, that's like the Internet Oscars. And you, dear listener, can vote for us in the People's Choice Award that's voted for by the public at webbyawards.com. Also on The Guardian's website today, Marcel Berlin's on how the English and French experience anxiety differently. guardian.co.uk/comment is free. Sarah Bernhardt is interviewed by John Patterson at guardian.co.uk/arts. And as AC/DC return to our shores, Tim Jones provides a bluffer's guide to heavy metal. guardian.co.uk/music. Gordon Brown is expected to come under further pressure today over the role of his special advisor. Damian McBride resigned at the weekend after details of an email conversation emerged in which he'd plotted to set up a website to spread scurrilous gossip about senior Conservatives. Well, the Prime Minister has written to the people targeted in the emails, including the Tory leader David Cameron, expressing his regret but not offering any personal apology. The Tories want to know who knew about the emails and the plans for the Red Rag website, and whether McBride or the Cabinet Office Minister Tom Watson, who was CC'd in the emails, broke any rules. The Guardian's political editor, Patrick Winter, says it's not just the Tories who are the victim of McBride.
What we're seeing is yesterday was a clutch of former Blairite ministers, Alan Milburn, the former party chairman, Stephen Byers, the former industry secretary, and Frank Field, the welfare minister, all claiming that they were victims of a kind of personalised briefings by allies of Gordon Brown, and sometimes alleging that this was actually conducted by Damian McBride, although there's no evidence either way that's the case. But Stephen Byers, for instance, said, "I've been the victim of McBride's aggressive and hostile media briefing on a number of occasions." The former party chairman, Alan Milburn, said he felt sick in his stomach when he read the details of the emails and said he'd been a victim. And Frank Field also said that there was a darkness at the heart of the Labour Party. And even Matthew Taylor, who's not a well-known figure, but he was a number 10 strategist, claimed that he thought that Damian McBride tried to blame him for some briefings quite wrongly. So all you're seeing is that there's a kind of backlash developing inside the Labour Party about the kind of culture that Gordon Brown allegedly allowed to be created around him in his path to become Prime Minister. And, you know, Gordon Brown's going to have to work very hard to kind of dampen that down, particularly since it just makes it a lot easier for David Cameron, which he did yesterday, to argue that there's a whole culture which Gordon Brown's allowed to grow up at Downing Street of briefings, and this is what the real significance of the revelation of these emails from Damian McBride is, that it actually represents something wider, a kind of negative attitude to politics.
Will Gordon Brown be able to change the culture? How will he convince people that he has changed the culture inside Number 10?
Well, it's going to be difficult because he's promised to do this once before. There was a kind of internal cabinet revolt last summer about this, and Damien McBride was allegedly going to be moved to one side and then finally ousted, and it didn't happen. So he's going to have to work extremely hard to show that this is all going to change. And I think there are loads of people in Number 10 who would like to do this. And what I think there's a frustration in cabinet is that this week was supposed to be the start of a kind of attack on conservative policy, and none of that is getting any airplay or any kind of media coverage because the whole focus is on this very personalised attacks that Damien McBride was allegedly planning.
Another person under pressure is Derek Draper, the former spin doctor who runs the Labour List website. Will he be able to carry on in that role?
Well, there are a lot of people calling for him to stand down, but the fact is the Labour List website is largely independent of the Labour Party. It's not funded by the Labour Party. Derek Draper is not paid by the Labour Party himself, so it's something he set up. He obviously got a lot of help from Number 10 in terms of encouragement, and I think Derek Draper's minded to try and battle on and stay in post on the basis that he deeply regrets responding in the way he did to the emails from Damien McBride, but he hadn't solicited them and they'd come out of the blue, and he wishes he hadn't responded because in the way he did, because he did respond saying they were brilliant, and he should have said, actually, no, this is something I can't touch. But at the moment, Draper's plans is to think about it and try and stay on and explain his position, but there is a lot of pressure for him to stand aside.
Patrick Winter. This is Guardian Daily. I'm John Dennis. Still to come, novelist Sebastian Barry, the author of The Secret Scripture, takes questions from the Guardian Book Club.
I've often tried to explain the nature of the language, say in the plays, because it's not Irish English or English, or it's something or other. And I sort of give it a kind of tuppenny halfpenny explanation in that the language in plays and maybe in books is a kind of afterlife of language.
But first, this week The Guardian's publishing a series of features examining the legacy of Britain's involvement in Iraq. Colonel Tim Collins sprang to prominence with the rousing speech he gave to his troops before the invasion in 2003. A copy of the oration is said to have hung in George Bush's Oval Office at the White House. Collins closed his speech, urging his soldiers to leave Iraq a better place for them having been there. Here, he reflects on the campaign.
Well, I think that ultimately it's clear that had there been a coalition that was like the which was brought together for the first Gulf War, it would have been much better. There's no doubt about the extent to which Saddam's regime was a wicked imposition on the Iraqi people. And I think it's unfair to say that for political reasons, that they should have carried on living like that for any longer than they needed to. But I think that the whole scheme ultimately was probably ill-conceived. But then that was compounded by some poor decisions that were taken shortly after the invasion. It's clear there was no understanding of the conditions that would be found, and there was no clear strategy. And that actually probably cost something of the order of 3 years of chaos before things could be restored. The United States performance initially was unimpressive in terms of they were impressive militarily. They quickly conquered the Iraqis, but had no idea what to expect and fared poorly in the beginnings of the insurgency. Their learning curve was extreme, and I have to say they've come out of it as a thoroughly impressive counterinsurgency force who have achieved tangible results in Iraq. The tale for the British, sadly, was the opposite. The British went in. I think that initially the army was a very different army that went in, and I think that the soldiers and men and women did well as individuals. I think that it exposed a poor level of command and staff, which has been swept away, a thoroughly poor performance at the strategic level, and what the Americans would characterise as an institutional lack of aggression and forward-leaning and a capacity for muddled thinking. And sadly, I think that whilst it has certainly been a less than impressive performance, I think the Army's a better Army for the experience. The performance in Iraq swept away any admiration the Americans had for the British Army, and I think that they looked at certainly not the soldiers, but the commanders and the lack of aggression and the incompetence at that level with some disdain. I think in the Middle East, generally, they were the people of Basra and Iraq were deeply disappointed by the poor performance of the British Army. And I think the British Army itself, at its lowest level, really up to the sort of middle ranks, realised that it was being held back and misguided and disappointed, but nevertheless continuing to deliver the goods. I think that there has been a significant clear-out at the top. The general staff now and those in command are of an order of competence far ahead of the people that took us into Iraq. That old order has gone, and I think that you will see a much enhanced British performance in Afghanistan and future conflicts. But it's all about re-establishing a good reputation. Sadly, the old reputation went with the desert sand.
So the armed forces and the army in particular have learned lessons?
Without a doubt, it's a better equipped army. It's a better led army. It's an army now with a clearer purpose. The damage done by the incompetence of the early to mid noughties is still there. The reduction in the regimental system, the capacity for obsequiousness that found us taking on far too many tasks. That is lasting damage which can't be repaired, but that legacy will endure. But I think that the army has made a remarkable recovery. It's a different army now, but nevertheless, I think it has a reputation again. I'm confident it will do in Afghanistan.
Tim Collins. 50 years of Cold War between the United States and Cuba is drawing to a close. Fidel Castro has been heaping praise on President Barack Obama, who's lifted a travel ban on Cuban Americans visiting Cuba just 90 miles from Miami. They'll also be allowed to send more money to relatives. And US telecoms companies can now apply to operate in Cuba. Further legislation is planned that would allow all Americans to visit Cuba. Rory Carroll, our Latin American correspondent, says Obama is the first president who's been able to sidestep Florida's powerful lobby of Cuban exiles.
Several reasons for this. One is that he was able to win Florida, which is a swing state, without getting a majority of the Cuban vote there. And so in a sense, that kind of broke the holes that the more militant Cuban exiles had on the state. Plus, the more younger Cuban exiles in the U.S. have shown to be more mellow in terms of their approach to the island. So Obama has been able to ride on this and to be able to now tweak the policy.
And what do the measures announced by President Obama mean for Cuba?
In the short term, it's good news for a lot of ordinary Cubans because there are more than 1.5 million Cuban Americans in the United States. Now, each one of those people has a family back in Cuba. And what this means is that they will now be able to visit any time they want. Up until now, they've only been able to visit once every 3 years, and they've been very limited in the amount of money they're able to either to send or to bring to Cuba. Now, they can travel every week if they wish, plus they can bring almost unlimited amounts of money, and they can also send many more products to help their families back in the homeland. And, of course, families there, the standard of living in Cuba is very low. People are struggling. Often they don't have enough soap or shampoo. They don't have proper, often they don't have decent food. So now there's going to be an economic lifeline for many of those Cubans who have relatives in the United States.
Fidel Castro is now 82. His brother Raul is 77. Will the Cuba of the Castro era soon be gone forever?
No one knows, but I don't think so, is a short answer. The government, the regime there has shown a very successful capacity to adapt. It's very pragmatic, despite its somewhat stern reputation for communist ideology. And we've seen, certainly in the past 2 years, that Fidel has very smoothly transferred power to his brother Raul. And the Communist Party and the army are the two strongest institutions in the island. And there's still no organized form of opposition there. Certainly it's not tolerated in the island. But even so, even the dissidents that are there don't have any widespread support. They're not even especially well known in Cuba. So I think in the short to medium term, the government in Cuba is still in a strong position.
Rory Carroll. In The Secret Scripture by the Irish playwright and novelist Sebastian Barry, themes of mental illness, grief and loss are explored against the backdrop of 20th century Ireland. The novel was named Costa Book of the Year, and it was also shortlisted for the Booker Prize. Sebastian Barry told members of the Guardian Book Club how his novels are conceived.
I've worked a lot in the theatre. I don't know why I've been so fortunate to do that. I'm the child of an actor, and maybe I just wandered into it in some way. And I've written, I don't know how many plays, maybe 10 or 11 or so. And I've often tried to explain the nature of the language, say in the plays, because it's not Irish English or English, or it's something or other. And I sort of give it a kind of Tuppenny Halfpenny explanation in that the language in plays and maybe in books is a kind of afterlife of language, just the same way that the characters themselves are characters in afterlife. You know, you're literally like Madame Blavatsky and Yeats at the kitchen table. You're calling them back from the past to be present. But in order to give them real sense of life, there's something has happened to the language. I'm not quite sure what that is. Shakespeare, as you know, is all in modern spelling. I was fascinated years ago to find out, this is more John's territory, but Shakespeare, used archaic spellings and archaic words in order to make his stuff look old. And this is now completely invisible to us because we just think it's all this difficult old language. But in fact, he was consciously using archaisms to give this effect. Now, I'm not quite doing that, but there's something of that maybe going the other way. Something happens in the workroom that I actually don't know what it is. I think it's something to do with being a human being rather than literature or being a writer. There's a sort of thing in a Homo sapiens sapiens, and maybe a Homo erectus had the same thing. Maybe Australopithecus was of this nature, or is so old, it predates even the leaps we've made, supposedly leaps. And, that's what it is. There's a quality to language when it's spoken. And then we write everything down. Of course, we're one of the few, we're very recent cultures who've done that. Mostly it's been repeated and learned off and carried from generation one to the next. And I think there's an element of that in this sort of work, where you're saying it, I hope, instinctively, and I hope memorably, or trying to, so that, in fact, you could sort of carry the book to the neighbouring county, half forget it, get it wrong, but repeat it. Because, as you know, some of Shakespeare's plays, are as the actors were able to give it to the person taking down the parts, taking down the sides, and they would have learnt it off, so they'd say, oh, no, and then I say that, and then I say that. And there's lots of gaps where the actor was going, what the hell did I say next? I can't remember. Do you remember? I don't know, remember. So there's these gaps, you know, which the scholars, of course, adore, I hope, I presume.
Sebastian Barry, and you can listen to a longer version of that interview at the book club at guardian.co.uk/books. Phil Maynard and Doug Hardy produced today's edition of Guardian Daily, and my name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.